Hello, and you're very welcome to another episode of the Life Well Lived podcast with me, Shane Breslin. This podcast is another episode in a short series that I've been working on for a little while, and it's about a topic that's of particular interest to me, and that is problem gambling / online gambling. Now, this is of particular interest to me because of my own experience, which I touch on across this interview series. As regular listeners will know, the mission of this podcast and everything that I'm doing in the Life Well Lived project in general is to try to offer guidance, support, and inspiration for anyone, no matter what your stage of life or the situation in which you're in right now, to navigate and overcome the challenges that life will inevitably throw at you, and thereafter to explore, embrace, and fully express your own absolutely unique individuality and live a life of energy, purpose, and happiness. And I firmly believe that the modes and mechanisms of gambling and online gambling is a major cause for a lot of unhappiness, depression, and anxiety that lies around us in the world right now. It is a hidden issue. Problem gamblers can lose thousands of euros or tens or even hundreds of thousands and keep their problem hidden from almost everyone. And it's an issue that is made incredibly worse, I think, by the pervasive power of the internet, which allows us to bet money we don't have on whatever we want 24 hours a day without ever having the cash in our hands or without ever having to leave our armchair. There's no doubt in my mind that gambling has caused untold heartache and stress in the lives of countless people and their families. And this short series of podcasts is my small attempt to explore a bit more about it so that people might better understand how gambling works in the internet age, how it can hijack our neurobiological pathways, and maybe most importantly, what we might be able to do about it when it gets out of hand or before it reaches crisis stage. Last week, I spoke to Venicia Leonidaki, who is a doctor and clinical psychologist at the National Problem Gambling Clinic in the UK. This episode is an interview with Declan Lynch, a journalist and writer with the Sunday Independent in Ireland. Declan has been writing about gambling and its effects for a number of years now, including the acclaimed and award-winning book, Tony 10, the story of Tony O'Reilly, a post office manager and fairly ordinary and typical Irishman who served time in prison after pleading guilty to stealing 1.75 million euros from OnPost, the Irish Postal Service, to fund his gambling addiction. We chat about the origins of Declan's interest in the subject of gambling over many years, how world economics are sort of built on gambling methodologies and behaviours. We talk also about the part that the media and government might have played in the explosion of the betting industry in recent years, and what the future might hold as we get to grips with the magnitude of the problems it might be causing in the lives of ordinary people around Ireland and all over the world. So I hope you enjoy this interview with Declan Lynch and that you also go back to check out the previous interview in this series with clinical psychologist Dr. Venicia Leonidaki. I'll include the link to that one in the show notes below. But enough from me, on with this week's show and my interview with journalist and writer Declan Lynch. Declan, it's good to talk to you.
Hi, Shane.
You've been writing for a long time. You've written plays and novels and journalism. You've been focusing on a chunk of what you've been working on over the last few years on the topic of gambling. Why?
Well, it's actually even more than a few years. It's actually now a ridiculous amount of time that I think of it, right? Because there's actually a book I wrote in 2009. I wrote the book in 2008 and it was published in 2009 called Free Money, which was based on, I felt like this online gambling is a massive phenomenon and it's going to get even worse. And, you know, better get this out quick because everybody's going to be onto it, right? But in order to even do that for a few years before that, I had to be thinking about it, right? So it's actually, it must be like 15 years now or something since I've been writing about gambling. Like there was a few kind of triggers for it, I suppose. One is I've always been interested in betting since I was a kid. Do you know what I mean? My father used to take me to race meetings, so I kind of know about it and I have a sense of it or a feel for it. But something clearly changed in the whole betting industry at a certain point. For me, one moment was we used to live up in Rathfarnham, and in the village of Rathfarnham, there was a betting office. I think it was maybe Ladbrokes or something, right? And I noticed one day that there was a new betting office. I think it was Boyle Sports. And I was just musing to myself, thinking there'll be a fight to the death between these two because it's only quite a small street, main street in Rathfarnham. And then a third one opened up. So, and it was just one of those things that something is going on here, right? Three betting offices. Like, they were almost the only things in Rathfarnham now, right? And I kind of started writing about that. And then we moved down here to South Wicklow. And the betting office in Rathfarnham that I would occasionally visit, there was no betting office kind of near here. And that didn't trouble me. I mean, I was very much just a very occasional, casual bettor. But a friend of mine had an online account. And I would say to him now and again, just put a fiver for me on something, right? But then when he moved down here, it was a bit relatively remote. So I thought, maybe I should get one of these online accounts, right? Mm. Never having seen one before, even, right? And I just opened up an online account, just looked up the website. Mm. And I was just so astonished by what I saw, right? The potential for ruining your life. It so struck me straight away that I think it just changed my entire perspective on this kind of industry. I guess as well, I had had experience of addiction in relation to drink, right? So I knew about that whole area. I'd been through it. I was some distance past it at this stage, but I understood about addiction and all that. So, and I'd been writing about that in the paper, in the Sunday Indo. So I guess it seemed normal to just, addiction is addiction, really. You know what I mean? It transfers in, from one thing to the other. So I kind of had a sense of that whole world and could see massive possibilities for it in online gambling and just started writing about it from there in the paper, and not in any sort of structured way, just like from time to time something would come up and would strike me as, yeah, this is really big, this thing, right? I mean, by this stage, like every town in Ireland had seven or eight betting offices on Main Street. The whole culture of the Celtic Tiger was a gambling culture, essentially.
Yeah.
The whole world was engaged in a gambling culture, if you look at it on the bigger level of the banking industry and financial services and all this, where the whole economy was of the world was more or less being put on the 330 at Kempton, proverbially. You know? And eventually I was talking to the publisher, Owen McHugh, and I would meet Owen now and again and just say, look, gambling, this is like really big, this thing. There's something going on here. And then the Nick Leeson stuff. There was a guy in Societe Generale in Paris who lost like a billion or something, right? Betting.
Just pick a number. Yeah.
And I was trying to find a way in, like, how do we cover this? This is really big, this thing. And eventually out of that came Free Money, which was done in a kind of a diary form, but had this kind of structure of, as I was trying online betting and also the issues around it. So one poignant aspect of it was, this was 2008 that I was writing it in, the year in which the world collapsed, the financial world collapsed through gambling.
Yep.
So like at the start of the year, I was able to write about Sean Quinn having a game of poker with his friends for a fiver every week. And a few months later, I was reading reports about him losing $2 billion or something in financial products. So that was the atmosphere. And since then, it's just kind of proceeded through until 2010. It was like the ultimate story of betting, of online betting.
We're talking about, you mentioned Celtic Tiger Ireland. So that time that you were writing about that, and that time that you noticed happening, I'm thinking 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007.
I guess so, yeah.
And that coincides with what I classify as a scrape with online gambling. And I was very lucky that I got out of it in a way that my health and life was still in one piece. It was 2006, the summer of 2006. There was the World Cup. Must have been around that time that I opened an online account. I didn't have a mortgage. I didn't have kids. And I had a credit card. And those three things are kind of dangerous. And over the course of that summer, through what you've just spoken about, the proliferation of incredible choice and the 18 hours a day live sport and options everywhere, and this really kind of perniciously appealing online. So, you know, when you open up Paddy Power or Betfair or whatever it was, to see this array of options for things. So I was very, very lucky. I remember a Sunday afternoon where I had put, my recollection is I put about €1,000 into the account, and it might have started with 10, 20, 30. There was €1,000 in it, and I had got that up to about 4,500. Mm. And I lost that 4,500 on one afternoon, on a Sunday afternoon in I'm saying June 2006 because the World Cup was on. And I was lucky because I had no access to any more money. And I managed to nip what was very, very dangerous in the bud. And if I had access to something that would have... If I had access to money, like Tony Ten in the book that we'll talk about, I don't know. Like, there but for the grace of God go I or whatever. So that's all that's more than... Like, when you wrote Free Money and when you started noticing this trend and where I was having that scrape, that's all more than 10 years ago now. What's your sense of the way things, and in the work on Tony Ten, in the intervening period from 2006, 7, 8 onwards, the direction this has taken over the last 10 years or so with the growth and proliferation of the internet and our mobile devices in our pockets?
Well, it's just the greatest racket of the age. I mean, it is the most extraordinary money printing operation of modern times. It's... You mentioned about the vulnerability you would have had to it, right? That's one of the points about it, that like there was a time you could have, even if you had a weakness for gambling, say, right, you could go through your whole life without it ever actually emerging. You wouldn't actually know it because it was quite doable to go through your life without really encountering much in the way of betting. Betting shops were places you had to actively go to. And why would you? If you know what I mean, unless by accident you could, you know. But generally speaking, you could escape. You can't escape anymore. There is no way. They'll get you, right? So that's one of the things. It's the kind of synergy of all these technologies as well, which is overpowering. You've got the television with all this great sport on it. You've got sport, which is an addictive thing in itself. You have the internet. You have it all coming together. So many people just, of course, it makes sport more enjoyable or whatever. You have more on it, all this kind of stuff, right? And because of all the advertising, it makes it seem like family entertainment. This is the thing. Once kids see that their football team has an ad blazing across the jersey, once there are ads all over the place on television, it's normal, right? It's a regular form of fun, right? And this is a really interesting part of it, that the industry has succeeded in that so brilliantly, and they are insatiable for ownership of space, right? They own so much now of sport, of media, that it's far too late now. It's over, right? They've won. Like, I hear people, what do you do about this? It's finished, right? About 10 years ago, something might have been done. It's too late now. It's damage limitation is where you're into, right? Because even in relation to media, right, I encountered with the book that there were certain papers, right, they just couldn't cover it because their sports coverage is owned by betting corporations or whatever. And I actually understand that, right? I understand that they're the only people who have money like that anymore, right? The drinks companies are, there's a stigma attached to them. Cigarettes is clearly more so. That stigma has never really attached itself to the betting industry. So the amount of real estate that they own is phenomenal. And they keep acquiring and acquiring and acquiring because they can. The regulations just aren't there. And like any bunch of lads who are in the middle of a gold rush, right, they're just going to keep going until somebody shouts stop. Very understandable again, right? But it's like the old story about Mark McCormack, the famous agent who turned all these golfers into millionaires. His negotiating tactic, when he was asked, why is he such a great negotiator? He said, my technique is I just keep asking for more until somebody shouts stop. Right? And it's like, this is what the betting industry is. They just more and more and more. And someday someone is going to shout stop. But until that day, it's just going to get bigger and bigger.
And you're right in that, yeah, like with the media and the sports landscape. I think I saw somebody recently talking about the volume of betting companies that sponsor teams in the Premier League. It's something like 3/4. And then you go down the leagues and you see lots of other betting companies, obscure betting companies that you've never heard of.
Yeah.
There are Chinese that are sponsoring whoever, somebody, the team that's down the bottom of the championship sponsored by a massive Asian gambling conglomerate. And I remember seeing something recently with, I think her name is Denise Coates,
the CEO of Bet365. Mm. And Bet365 was this family-owned, Denise Coates and her dad, I think her dad set up the company. So it was a family-owned bookmaker. Mm. And it completely embraced the technology, the internet. And her salary in one of the last couple of years was 260-something million. Salary for 1 year. She was the highest paid CEO in Europe or something like that. And by an order of magnitude, the highest paid CEO in Europe. And she was the head of a company that, to all intents and purposes, when you think of what the company's creating value in the world, like that creates maybe not a whole pile of tangible value, but she's the volume she's able to pay herself, never mind everybody else. And never mind the money that's retained in the company. Yeah, so you're not optimistic. Is that fair to say? Or
not at all, no. Like in Ireland, we still have legislation that's been around since 2013. There's supposedly a regulator's office being set up. And we were told in May that that would take 2 years, right? Why would it take 2 years? There's an emergency going on. It actually is quite educative about what happens, why other things don't happen, right? Like, there's a regulator in England now, right? And it does very, very good work, incidentally, right? Really heavy fines for all the usual kind of litany of bad carry-on that bookies get up to, right? It's a serious thing. It isn't actually a token thing at all. And if you were trying to do this something here, you just copy it. I mean, it's not like they have to invent something, yeah, right? So they have a ready-made model there, and yet it takes 2 years. So always from the official side, from the government side, from the authority side, there's this endless vacillation or waiting, and it just drags on. And meanwhile, on the bookie side, they're just gobbling everything up, right? They have urgency. They're not hanging around, and they're lobbying away there, right? And they've got arguments on their side as well. Like, you know, they provide employment, they make loads of money. Like, the biggest operators in the world are Irish. Do you know what I mean? So these are all arguments that governments are hugely vulnerable to. And so you've got all these vested interests coming in on one side. And meanwhile, the officialdom just moves so slowly. And I think anything to do with the internet as well, the authorities are so behind the curve, generally, right? They're years and years behind it, right? And likewise with online gambling. And now it's America. America has fallen to Paddy Power and its conglomerate, which is mind-boggling. It's absolutely mind-boggling. All this has happened without really America.
Yeah, America has sort of, like, because it was always, for whatever reason, it was always kind of pockets, like Atlantic City and Las Vegas, and there was, that's changing, is it?
Yeah, they always had this weird situation in America that it seemed as though there was a kind of a social contract in America that gambling was given to the gangsters, like the organized crime, you have the gambling, right? And therefore, places like Vegas and Atlantic City grew up, right? These kind of destination gambling venues, right? That's now been stopped, isn't it? They're tidying the thing up, right? And so you will have a normalized gambling in many states now. And this means that sports in America are going to gobble this up because there's going to get a huge, like golf, for example, right? Golf is dying as a TV sport because no one wants to watch anything but Tiger Woods, right? Golf, though, people are going to be betting on golf. Right? All people who have no interest in golf suddenly are interested in golf, right? That's just an example, right? That brings so much more into the coverage of it, and et cetera. The more popular sports will get a boost, et cetera. So it kind of has this, it's hydra-headed in that sense. You then have the corruption of sports by betting. My God, Athlone Town and Longford Town was the subject of a famous betting scam involving whatever Far Eastern syndicates, you know, things unimaginable a few years ago. Like, I'm from Athlone, and here we are, like, at the town where the team I supported, you know, as a lad, becomes famous throughout the world for a betting scandal, right? So this is just one of the issues, almost a side issue, right? Corruption about, like, it's inevitable that a lot of sports players are not paid much. Tennis?
Yes.
Tennis is gone. Tennis is now, you couldn't trust anything happening in tennis really anymore, particularly at the lower levels, because you have tournaments where players are getting like a few hundred quid to play. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of people are betting on matches in the middle of nowhere, right? So there's going to be bad stuff going on there inevitably.
And we saw that in snooker as well. John Higgins had famously fell victim to a scoop in the snooker scene as well. And it is a side issue. The corruption thing is massive and massively important. But
that's just one of the issues, right? There are issues of money laundering. It's so huge, right? And yet at a public level, when you hear people talking about it, right, they always have this tendency to minimize it, right? So when they're talking about alcohol, they talk about it as a serious problem and all that. When they talk about gambling, there's always a moment when they say, now I know that most people can have a bet and sure there's no problem whatsoever, but there are a few people who just, you know, have extreme cases, right? They don't do that with any other area. And it's also not true. There isn't a vast majority of people who are safe from all this, right? This is the key to a lot of the stuff that I'm writing. We don't know yet the damage that is out there, right? Nobody bothers doing proper research on it. The bookies have been putting out a hilarious figure for years of 1%, right? Which is a joke, but it's still out there, right? So with all these kids, the young men particularly, getting into it with smartphones and all this, we have no idea of the scale of the thing, but I am damn sure it's a lot worse than is officially recognised and will be a lot worse. It just can't be otherwise. Every part of this I have approached on the basis of the most simple common sense, right? What I observe with my own eyes, right? And you go anywhere and you have lads betting on things, right? In a way that never happened before in human history, right? So you're not going to have 1%. Still being the figure for people with problems. But yet there's this, the vast, overwhelming majority of people, it's just a harmless bit of recreation. But you have these, almost these kind of loopers who just spoil it for everybody else. And it just isn't like, that isn't a true representation of it. There's a whole cohort of people, there's a large minority of people who are very vulnerable. You gave your own example of that. I'd say there are so many people. One of the things about Tony Tenn was that a lot of people read that book and said, there but for the grace of God, right? Because there are a lot of people just on the brink and it doesn't really take much to push you over. In a certain set of circumstances, you're Tony Tenn.
Absolutely. And I want to get deep into that. I want to talk a little bit more about that. You've mentioned that you've had a bet. Do you still have a bet, or what's your own personal relationship with it now?
I'd have, I would say every few months, I'd have a bet, a cash bet.
Yes.
In a betting office, in a whimsical level. Do you know what I mean? I'd see something like, I'd have a single bet usually on a football match, and that's it. Like, when I was a kid, I loved betting, right? I know money, but I loved horses. I wanted to be a bookie. This is one of the ironies of this, right? Maybe this all really is about that, right? That my father used to take me to race meetings and I loved it. I really did. And still do. I still love the kind of races, right? But it just looks so great to be a bookie, right? Just the great satchels full of money and going to race meetings. You know, so this is what I wanted to be. As a teenager, I remember asking some man, how do you get to be a bookie, right? And he said, oh, you need a bond and all this, right? And I'd worked at it. You know, I'd gone quite a long way down the road of researching how I would become a bookie. And of course, well, I kind of never happened because I would have been ridiculously bad at it. I just don't have much of a head for figures. But I would always be doing things like Yankees and every so often, and Cheltenham was a big thing for me. So that's where I really got into it. And then I just gave it up. I was working with a rock and roll magazine with Hot Press, yeah. And you just kind of drifted away from things like horse racing and sport for a while, you know? And so that's really what happened. But I never lost that sort of sense. I remember once thinking I was going to get the form book. You could get the form books sent to you. Like, I was that into it. I would be listening to the results of the races every evening on the radio. At about 5 to 6, right? They would read the results there. And I was there marking it up, them out. Like, I was a serious student of this stuff. And what happened eventually, I think, as going to race meetings, I couldn't stand the pain anymore of backing horses that didn't win, which is a very lucky thing, actually. I just think, oh no, I can't do this anymore. I can't. I love betting on race. I love racing, right? I can't stand it anymore. I can't stand the tension. I can't stand the. So this is a great blessing, that because there are some people who love that, right? I loved it to a certain extent, right? but not enough. It was just causing me, whatever way that little balance was tilted, it kept me the right side of it, right? And so I never got it, went any further with it. But there are some people who really, actually, that's where they really love it. They love the pain. They love that kind of the pain and then the release of that. But
I remember like the things you speak about there, about the form book and studying, like I was that person as well.
Really?
And, like,
yeah,
it's so
yeah.
much, and yeah. lots of people, like I remember when I started going out with my girlfriend, now my wife, 16, 17 years ago, like early 2000s, I remember, because I was very much a student of, like I still love horse racing, but I've got the betting and gambling aspect of it has really tainted it for me. Like I don't like that part of it. I'd almost enjoy the Cheltenham Festival without even looking or thinking about the form or the odds. Like, so that's tainted it. And I was interested that Davy Russell, the jockey, said something, I think it was last year before the Grand National or after he Tiger Roll to win the Aintree Grand National. He said that every time that horse racing is spoken about on the radio, like, you know, in the sports shows, every time it's spoken about is in the context of the odds. And it's never spoken about in terms of the stories and the actual drama that makes up 80, 90% of it, quite apart from the odds. And that is something that I've noticed and almost fallen out of love with horse racing, or definitely have a completely different relationship with it now than I did back then. Because I remember, like, I remember when I started going out with my, that story that I started and stopped, when I started going out with my girlfriend, now wife, and I remember getting the Racing Post and looking through the form in the Racing Post. And she was looking at me and kind of going, what does all that mean? Like, what are you doing? What's that mean? And I was like, it was only then that I realised I had to learn this language. Yeah. This language that has all these code words and symbols in the paper.
It's great stuff. Like, you see, the one thing in writing about addiction generally, which, like I do another column, 50 Ways in the Sunday Indo, and for me, one of the hugely important things is you can't write it from a position of being outside of the whole thing and saying, isn't all this terrible and what foolish people you are and how, you know, you have to, if you can't convey or understand what people are getting out of it, it's useless, right? A lot of people who talk about addiction don't have that. That's why it's not interesting. They can't actually communicate because they're not empathetic in a way, right? I think to have any sort of chance of communicating at all about addiction, you have to understand why people are doing this, what they're getting out of it, and like not to deny that, right? People are willing to go to the gates of hell for this stuff. They're not doing that because they're having a terrible time all the time, right? Yeah. They're doing it because some of the time they're having a great time, right? And you have to acknowledge that and cope with it and then try to figure out at what stage does it turn into hell. Right, which it does. But in order to do that, you have to chart the journey properly and you have to understand and in a way coming at it from a position of sympathy as much as anything else, like to the extent that literally I wanted to be a bookie. Yes. I wanted to be one of these guys that I'm supposedly kind of hounding now. But like that may be the psychology or the psychological reason for me doing it. I'm not sure. But maybe just it was all done and dusted or all decided for me when I was like 14 and that this is my position here and I'm still trying to kind of deal with the bookies or whatever, except not by backing horses.
The addictiveness of that can be, like just what you said there, is like totally, it's really, really hard to convey if you haven't experienced it. Huh. And I know what the rush of having a bet, like you know, that moment, maybe in a horse race, and I'm thinking about it now, maybe in a horse race and maybe it's three fences from the finish and the horse that you've picked and put a bet on is moving into contention and that rush that comes at that point, it's very physiological and it's like there's whatever it is, endorphins or whatever it is that's flooding your kind of brain synapses at that time, but it is something that is very, very powerful. And I think that is totally, it's all about the addictiveness of it. Like, yeah. Anyway, I want to talk about Tony Tenn. Where did you first come across that story?
Oh, just in the paper. And I wrote about it then in the Sunday Indo, just as part of all the other stuff I was writing about. Like, it struck me, it had everything. All the stuff that I've been writing about. And it had this wonderful kind of energy to it, apart from just as a story, but also had these amazing aspects to it, like the fact that he had been a guest of Paddy Power in VIP enclosures and stuff, which is a direct contravention of like the responsible gambling stuff, right? That was a really important part of it for me. And what happened was I just wrote about it in the paper, and when Tony's court case came up, and then he wrote to me, he was just being sent to jail, and his, first of all, communicated to me through his father, who got on to me. And always you're worried when somebody gets onto you about something you've written in the paper, because you automatically assume that they're going to complain, right? But in fact, he liked it. I suppose that so much of the stuff had been written about him was like tabloid stuff, which was very sensationalist and basically had no awareness of addiction or any of these things. Right?
Dehumanizing, yeah.
Very much so. Mm. And looking at it now, it's so dehumanizing. It really is bad stuff if you're on the other end of it. And a lot of it is fairly inaccurate and all this kind of stuff. But he wrote to me anyway, just to say that he thought the piece, he liked the piece, I guess because it had put it in the context of an industry generally and the broader issues. And we just made contact that way and wrote back and forth a bit. And then when he got out of jail, we continued like to talk and to meet up now and again. And like I always had a sense that that story, it has to be told in some form. Right. And I wasn't even sure what form. Originally, there was a notion of maybe television or something like that. And we worked on that for a while. But then, see, Tony, it was a huge thing for him to do, because as far as he was concerned, like, I mean, he had been through this horrendous experience on so many levels. And there's a huge inclination to just sort of move on from it. Right. You don't want going back in there. Right. And so many bad things had happened and people were upset and all this kind of stuff. So his and a completely understandable response would be, no, I'm now going to just live the rest of my life and forget about it. Right. Or not talk about it. But he also was highly aware. He's a very bright guy, Tony. And he was very aware just of his own story and how powerful it was and how much it could tell the world, if you like, about this thing. Even the fact that he survived is amazing. Yeah. You know, the fact that he's alive is itself a huge thing. And not many people who have been there have come back. So that in itself is very important. And over time, we figured out that, look, it would do a book. And it literally took a couple of years, like. And eventually, we just got down to that. And it over maybe a year or so, we did it. And it was great doing it with Tony because he has such a good memory and an understanding of his own position or what happened. So my challenge was, how do I do this justice? Do you know what I mean? It's such an amazing material and story. And like, it's always that fear you have of like, you can't disappoint with this. Do you know what I mean? You have to match. You have to kind of do justice to it. So like the response has been just fantastic. It's been out about 18 months now and it's still out there. Do you know what I mean? It's still there. We're still getting these great reactions to it. And they're really the sort of responses you get, which you don't. I mean, I've had other books out and you just don't get this normally. You don't get people saying things like, oh, it changed their life, that kind of stuff. Like those kind of really big, over the top kind of reactions. So it's been such a great experience. And like, I really think it's done something and it's made a contribution to a subject that has so much nonsense written about and so much lies really out there and so much falsehood and nonsense in general. To have actually a truth as kind of powerful as that, I think it's something, right? I mean, my God, it's ultimately you've got a monster out there that you're up against. But at least there is some, like you increasingly the media are getting aware of it. Some papers are running campaigns about it. It's still, there's nothing coordinated. There's still too much of the media is actually owned by betting corporations. Mm. But it's something and you can't just sort of let that happen. If you have something to say about it, you need to say it. Like,
and in the construction of the book, because it's so tangible when you're reading it, that at 2:10 on a certain day, there was this thing happening. Did Tony have a file of his records, his betting account records? Did you have that to work with while you were putting it together?
Well, yeah. You see, the structure of the book was kind of dictated by the fact that he got the complete history of his betting from Paddy Power in relation to the court case. When he was able to get that through some means. And it was like 600 pages of bets. And once I had that, I thought, right, this is it. That this is how, if you like, the book is going to be structured. Because it literally starts, there's €1 on the first page, I guess, when he's just opening the account and trying it out and seeing how it works. And by the end of it, there are like 30,000, 40,000, 30,000, and it's not even 12 o'clock in the day yet, right? So you will never get a more chilling kind of narrative of the decline into hell of an addicted gambler. So that was, if you like, that dictated that the narrative to a great degree. And then we could focus in on stuff and say, no, around here you're having this Ben, and then Tony would recall what was happening around then. But I think one of the main decisions that I made about it was that for the first half of it, certainly, I wrote it from, if you like, I wrote the book about him. Like, a lot of these books are in the voice of the main character themselves. But I'm never too happy with that. I always think there's something kind of false a bit about that, because it always sounds like the author anyway, you know? So we'll usually, it's very rare that someone can actually get those things.
It's a real skill, yeah.
Yeah. So I thought, no, to hell with it. Yeah, I write it about Tony, which also kind of enabled me a bit to kind of bring in some of the issues or smuggle them in into the narrative as well. Then once he's caught and he goes to jail, or at least he's charged and all that, then his voice takes over in his own diaries. He'd written these journals, which he kept meticulously. This is why it was such a valuable experience, like that he, as this was going on, when he was getting treatment, when he was in jail, he was keeping these detailed daily records of the thing, right? Which version of which, or, you know, an edited version of which go into the book and are absolutely fascinating about what goes on in these places. Most people don't really know. So you have that as well. And then towards the end, it comes back and it's a third person thing again. And I just describe where he is now and how it all turned out.
The people around Tony, because gambling, in so many cases, it can be so easy to hide, even if the volumes are phenomenal, in a way that drink and alcohol or sex or pornography are much more difficult to hide. Yeah, that you go out and you drink €50 worth of whiskey and people are going to know it. But you can gamble €50,000 worth online and you can go about your business as if nothing happened. What about the people around Tony? Did they suspect, or how did that play out?
Well, whatever they suspected would have been on such a small level as to be irrelevant. Like, I mean, his wife had no idea, right? Even till the end, even on the day he kind of, there was an audit eventually, and he just took to the road. I mean, he drove to the north. It's like a kind of a car chase type of thing, right? But even then, his wife was thinking, no, it's a tiger kidnapping, right? There was his best friend, Niall. It was an interesting thing because when Tony was 11,500 up, right, he spoke to Niall and he said, look, I'm betting, and they both were saying, you're betting a fair bit these days, right? But Tony said, yeah, but I'm actually doing well. But he said, I'm getting out of it now. And they had a chat about it, right? Because they were, he was aware that he was getting in a bit deep. Okay, he'd won. I mean, that was a fair amount of money to be talking about, even in relation to betting. But the conversation was of the nature of, I'm getting out. And he meant it as well, right? Except the following day, the Galway races were on. And he's in his post office. He gets involved in the chat and all that about it. By the end of the day, it's all gone, right? And that was a really big moment in it, right? But from Niall's point of view, I mean, his friend Niall, you know, that, so there would have been a conversation like that. And he would see Tony would be very kind of stressed. Sometimes they'd be playing games of cards or something, and Tony would be distracted by stuff. Or Tony would talk about like Bayern Munich or something. And they're both very into football, but Niall's, what the hell is he talking about German football for, you know? But nothing remotely on the scale that eventually it became. In other words, it was a kind of mild concern that you would have about someone you know very well, but nothing like what it actually turned out to be, which is, again, one of the great sort of aspects of this, that you can do that. You really can with betting, right? If you're serious about it as a gambler, you become so kind of adept at lying and kind of getting out of trouble that you actually feel invincible. And this is what Tony says a few times in the book, that he actually felt that no matter what happens, he could get out of it. He had become so kind of pathological about it that he was programmed almost like to always have an answer or an excuse or to be able to play one thing off against the other. And you get very good at it. So it would take great insight on the part of anyone to really suss it. And it's easy to hide money now as well. The only people who really knew about it were the bookies. They knew all about it, you know, and they weren't talking. So,
and things like that as well, like compared to alcohol or drugs, for instance, substances. Mm. When you're addicted to alcohol or drugs, you're never in the mindset of that the thing is the solution to the problem. Whereas when you're gambling, if you're 50,000 in the red, there is a part of your brain is thinking, you know, if this clicks and that clicks and this clicks, I can get out of this. So the problem, the gambler sometimes thinks, I think, the problem gambler sees what's becoming the problem as a solution to the problem, as one possible solution to the problem.
And you see, the point about that is, in one level, he's right. This is the ultimate tragedy of the gambler is that, like, in some cases, he's not wrong. And that's one of the real diseases of it, that, like, it's about being right. People love being proved right about things. And so it's about your ego. It's beyond actually all the normal, the stuff with alcohol or drugs, because it's almost more fundamental things are at stake. It's your whole personality, your ego, the fact that you feel you're good at this thing, the fact, you know, you're a kind of smart guy. It's but your whole sense of yourself is involved in this thing, right? And any research such as it is into it would indicate that gamblers tend to be maybe brighter than average, that these aren't like just idiots, like, do you know what I mean? They may be doing unbelievably stupid things, but fundamentally they're kind of bright. And that's another tragedy, because they think, sure, a smart fellow like me isn't going to get caught in this. So everything actually conspires against them. Even their positive attributes become weapons against themselves, right? They, again, a bit like the guys in the banks, right? They thought they were great. You know what I mean? Part of the reason they destroyed the world was that they simply could not entertain the notion that geniuses like themselves could end up losing money. Like, said, sure, we're great.
And we've talked about, or we've used the word lads a few times. Do you think that this is, or in the work you've done, or the people you've spoken or listened to, is this an exclusively or predominantly male phenomenon, or is there a sense that this is impinging upon the women as well?
Well, sports betting, which is what I suppose I've been mainly on about, is still overwhelmingly, I think, a male thing. And a lot of these issues that we're talking about, like to do with ego, are very male issues, right? However, part of the black genius of the online betting purveyors is that they are inveigling women in hugely successfully with other things like casino games, all that side of it. Not like football or horses, or that they're still mostly male, right? But all that other stuff, they finally cracked it. I mean, for centuries, bookies couldn't, they only had half the human race, if you like. The other half didn't care, right? They would have a bet once a year in the Grand National, and if they won, they'd go off and spend the money somewhere else, right? They didn't get it, basically, right? And now online gambling has actually cracked that thing for them, right? Now, I've said this a few times before, and I still maintain it hasn't come to pass yet, but I wonder if in that is actually the seeds of the bookie's downfall. Because one of the problems you have with gambling, with men gambling, is that at a lot of levels, people don't care. They just think, look at young fellas, blackguards, out wasting money, backing horses, to hell with them, right? They're not sympathetic figures, right? Even though it could be your son or it could be anyone's son. And they're just blackguards, you know what I mean? To hell with them, right? However, mother of four commits suicide due to gambling debts. Then you're talking about Liveline. Do you know what I mean? Then it's different, right? I think this is one of the main problems with it, that like a lot of the victims are like just young men who are not great at expressing themselves, who are not really kind of sympathetic figures to official Ireland or whatever, right? Mm. That's just one of the many issues here. Mm. So while the bookies have, one of their many triumphs has been attracting women to a thing that they have never been literally in the history of the world before, it could also become problematic for them in the long term, I think, as the victims pile higher. So
the people on the other side of this are the free marketers or the free capitalists.
And,
they might say, where does personal responsibility come into this? Or how should the companies or the government, like, should they have any part to play, or should we not let people be have complete free will? What would you say to
thing about those lads first is that, right, first of all, they only have one line in life, right, about, you know, the nanny state, right? And they apply that to more or less everything, every issue of humanity, right? So they're just cliched sort of merchants, and they've got an ideological view of the world, which is easily kind of cancelled out by even the most simple of evidence, right? Seatbelts, right? Are seatbelts the nanny state? Well, I mean, what's wrong with just getting into your car and driving at 200 miles down the road? You're a free man. Go out there and stop. If these people don't like it, fuck them, right? So, however, over time, the human race formed this notion that there was a consensus whereby if you wear seatbelts, you have a better chance of not killing yourself or killing other people, right? And while it was a bit of a drag for a while, people thought, in everything we do, right, there's a level of corporate responsibility which needs to be there, right? On the issue of personal responsibility, the one I know best, which is Tony O'Reilly, right? Tony went to jail, right? Tony took as much responsibility as any person can possibly take, right? He denied none of what happened. His life was destroyed in every conceivable way. He doesn't argue otherwise. And what did the corporation, what responsibility did they take, right? It's a huge issue, this corporate responsibility. It's as if these guys who come out with the sort of, well, what about personal responsibility? They've got this weird view of the world where the powerless individual is supposed to take all the responsibility and the powerful corporation just moves on, right? We're not in the responsibility business, right? This is clearly twisted to an extraordinary degree, right? The bookies themselves profess their responsible gambling. So in a corporate PR sense, they feel even that there's some responsibility on them, right? Now, it takes like teams of regulators working 24 hours a day to keep them to that, right? And they consistently breach it in all sorts of ways. As I said, the English regulator is always hitting them with fines, right? But they acknowledge that at least, right? And I suppose the simplest way to put it, if you have a very dangerous thing which is hugely enjoyable, you have to regulate it. Everybody understands that. You don't drive down the road at 200 miles an hour in a Ferrari because there are good reasons not to, right? It would be much better crack to do it. But it's highly dangerous and very enjoyable. So as adults, as grown-up people, we find a way to deal with that, which is usually you bring in some form of reasonable regulation or whatever. And then life goes on. I think from our conversation, I have nothing against sports betting or sport or anything like that. It is the greatest pleasure of my life. I love it, right? There is no part of me that wants to see anything banned in any shape or form, right? Yeah. And in fact, I think all of those ideas are disastrous. Stopping, banning things, being sort of draconian about stuff, it doesn't work and it's stupid, right? But my God, with something of this magnitude, you so need to have regulations. You need to have some kind of protections.
Yes.
For very vulnerable people.
And you talk about seatbelts and like some of the other things that have been brought in Ireland over the last 10, 15 years, like the smoking ban, drink driving limits. They're all public health initiatives, really. And this, I would say, is like a very big public health problem that isn't being addressed. Do you get the sense, or is there anybody at an official or governmental or policy, like, are there people that you get the sense are aware of the magnitude of the problem and are doing anything to take action?
Well, I mean, there are some politicians who have openly been on about this for some time. You know, even Anne Rabbit of Fianna Fáil has been fairly consistent in sort of talking about this. There have been one or two others. Like, the Department of Justice is wheeling out its legislation bit by bit. It's working on it, right? But they are under huge pressure. I understand this, right? They're up against an industry full of extremely clever and powerful people. And it's always difficult when you have those kind of vested interests, in Ireland, certainly, to get anything done. So there is some movement. On a broader level, I don't think there is any real understanding in a sort of a general sense of how serious the thing is. I don't think they've really, if you like, internalized it, right? Everybody gets drink. Everybody gets the dangers of drink and the dangers of whatever, heroin and all that. They don't really get the gambling, I don't think. And you have just this accumulation of stuff where you'll see story after story after story of some guy stole 200 grand from the bank he worked in. Loads of these stories have been out there now, but it's one at a time. And like, it hasn't still, for some reason, really hit people, this scale of the thing. And it's almost like something that is, it reminds me actually a little bit about the banking thing, that there's this sense of, oh, that doesn't look right. That doesn't look right, but sure, we'll go on anyway. And they don't realize that there's a much bigger thing going on. Do you know what I mean? There's a much bigger structural thing in place, and that there's this generation of young men who have grown up with this stuff, right? And many of whom are now addicted, right? And the results of that will eventually appear. A lot of it, I think, at the moment is actually hidden. For all the quick cases that go to court, a lot of them are hidden. They don't. Nobody wants to be, if say some guy embezzles 40 grand from the company he works in, they mightn't want to be involved in a court case and bad publicity and all this kind of stuff. Who knows how much of that stuff is going on? Except, again, common sense would tell you there's a lot of it, right? So even the cases that get to court is really the tip of the iceberg. And you just have to just read the paper, you'll see it. But at an official level, no, it really hasn't sunk in yet. Apart from in certain pockets, you have individual politicians who would have read this. Some of them actually would have read Tony 10 and actually found it pretty shocking, right? But not enough of them, like, you know. So,
last question. I'm very grateful for your time. In the work you've been doing, and you've been speaking about it, you've been writing about it, the Tony 10 book also, Sports Book of the Year last year, right? Congratulations.
Well, the Irish Times made their Sports Book of the Year. Yeah.
Have you got any heat?
Actually, amusingly, we were nominated for the Unpussed non-fiction book of the year. But unfortunately, due to the fact that one of us had stolen 1.75 million from the sponsors, we weren't really all that optimistic. And on the night, we didn't actually get that one. But
have you got any heat from the work you've been doing in the paper? You've been making a ruckus about this issue. Has that resulted in any heat at all?
No, nothing sort of a negative nature, right? And I think the reason is this, right? The bookies have a strategy for dealing with all these controversies, and that is to totally avoid them, to have nothing whatsoever to do with them, right? If you watch any television programme, say that Claire Byrne will have a discussion on gambling, there'll be no bookies there, right? They don't show up, right? They used to. A few years ago, when I'd be on the radio, there would be some guy from Paddy Power might show up. That stopped, right? You occasionally have someone from, like, say, smaller bookmakers' federations will turn up to a radio discussion. But when any of these kind of scandalous stories are there, they are not in the room, right? They have decided quite sensibly, I guess, that there's nothing in it for them. They haven't a leg to stand on, right? They are just, like, they're bang to rights, right? So their strategy is simply to shut up, right? And, like, what could they say about the Tony case? There's nothing to be said, right? They took all the money, they breached all their own kind of guidelines, and they moved on, right? What can they say?
Nothing.
Do you know what I mean? Except we are putting measures in place now to improve this, etc., right? There's no point for them to be just sitting there kind of saying, we're very sorry about this, right? What they do is they pump more and more and more money into positive stuff, into advertising and sponsorship, right? They are only interested in kind of hype, right? And they do that all the time, right? That's their connection with the world. They are not there to be sitting on serious current affairs programs being interrogated by hard questions. And that's the way it is. So I've often sent them letters, sent them emails questioning things. And the vast majority of the time it just comes back saying, we do not discuss individual cases. And that's about being the height of my interaction with them. And there you have it. Like, you know, again, I understand it. I understand where they're coming from. But my God, you would think at some stage they would just show up and kind of express some form of remorse or whatever, but they don't. That's not their strategy. So,
and meanwhile, the gold rush continues.
Yeah, they're too busy.
Declan, thank you.
Thanks, Shane.